This is a download from the BBC. For details of our huge new range of audio for free download or podcast and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcast.
Now for the World Book Club, and this week's programme contains some strong language of a sexual nature.
BBC.
BBC.
You're with the BBC. Hello, I'm Harriet Gilbert, and welcome to the World Book Club, coming this month from the Swan Hotel in Hay-on-Wye, a small Welsh market town recently twinned with Timbuktu in Mali, and which is famous as the world's first book town. This is partly because Hay's got more than 30 bookshops, but it's also because it hosts a high-profile literary festival, one of whose stars this year is the internationally best-selling American novelist John Irving. And John Irving is with us here to answer questions from an invited audience and from BBC listeners around the world about his breakthrough comic masterpiece, The World According to Garp. John Irving, welcome to the World Book Club.
Thank you.
Have you had time to look at Hay's 30 bookshops?
I've not looked at one. I considered buying a pair of Wellingtons.
It is quite muddy this year. Yeah,
but I live in a ski town in Vermont, and when the snow melts in March and April, there's so much mud. I probably have three pairs of Wellingtons, and I didn't want to bring a fourth pair home, so I decided just to make a casualty of a pair of shoes.
Well, it's not surprising you haven't had time for the bookshops, because yesterday you were talking and later today you're going to be reading from your novel in progress, Last Night in Twisted River. But now we're going back 30 years. John Irving's written a number of widely loved novels, including A Prayer for Owen Meany and The Cider House Rules. But The World According to Garp, published in 1978, was the book that first brought him international fame. It tells of the life and death of T.S. Garp, a man whose existence swings even more wildly than most between heartbreak and farce. Garp's mother, a nurse during World War II, has no desire at all for a man in her life. So she conceives her son with a terminally wounded turret gunner, one of her patients, whose last remaining faculty is the ability to procreate. Garp, fatherless before he's even born, pours his boyish obsessiveness first into school wrestling, then, to impress the teenage daughter of his coach, into writing short stories. And young Helen is impressed. She and Garp eventually marry, have sons, and ride the somewhat rocky road of Garp's evolving literary career. While Garp's mother, having published a truthful account of her life and Garp's conception, becomes a feminist heroine. Tensions abound, but are held in balance until... But before we get on to that, let's start at the beginning. John Irving, would you read from the beginning of The World According to Garp, where we first meet his mother?
This chapter I called Boston Mercy, because growing up in New England, it seemed that Boston had little mercy in it. Garp's mother, Jenny Fields, was arrested in Boston in 1942 for wounding a man in a movie theater. This was shortly after the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor, and people were being tolerant of soldiers because suddenly everyone was a soldier. But Jenny Fields was quite firm in her intolerance of the behavior of men in general and soldiers in particular. In the movie theater, she had to move three times, but each time the soldier moved closer to her until she was sitting against the musty wall, her view of the newsreel almost blocked by some silly colonnade, and she resolved she would not get up and move again. The soldier moved once more and sat beside her.
Well, the soldier is going to regret moving yet again, because Jenny Fields carries a scalpel in her pocket and she uses it rather ferociously but single-mindedly on his arm. Let's now have a question from the World Book Club audience here at Hay-on-Wye. Yes, the lady here at the front.
Heather Barton, Hereford. With the intensity of the book and all the events that unfold, when you started writing this novel, did you have an end point in mind, or did you just find that the story evolved as you went along? Did it ever have a momentum of its own, and did you always feel in control of the plot?
I always feel in control of the plot. I always know what's going to happen before I write the first chapter. I knew what happened at the end of this novel. I wrote the last sentence. In the case of this novel, only one out of my 12 novels, I did not write the last sentence first, but in truth I did. In The World According to Garp, We Are All Terminal Cases used to be the first sentence of this novel, and I kept pushing it ahead. It became the first sentence of chapter 2, the first sentence of chapter 3, then it became a last sentence of a subsequent chapter and a last sentence. And finally, midway through the book, I thought, no, it's the last sentence of the novel. And that's the only novel of mine. This is the only novel of mine that I didn't actually know it was a last sentence when I wrote it first. All the others came first, and I knew what they were, last sentences. But I always knew that this was a double assassination story, that Garp's mother, the feminist icon, would be killed by a man who hates women, and Garp would be killed by a woman who hates men.
Another question for John Irving.
Joe Spearing, also from Hereford. I found Garp intriguing, amusing, shocking, horrific in places, but also moving and latterly cathartic and somehow even comforting, because I was able to go to some pretty awful places, but still come out of it with my sense of humanity intact. I'd love to know if you deliberately set out to put your readers through the mill because you feel we all need enlightening about what really goes on, or if it just comes naturally to you as a terrific storyteller.
My novels are always written with emotional intention, not intellectual intention. I set out to move you, to touch you emotionally, to make you laugh, to make you cry, to make you sorry, to make you sympathize. I don't feel that writing is about pleasing myself. Herman Melville, a fellow New Englander, used to say, woe to him who seeks to please rather than appall. To appall is good, to get someone's emotional attention. At the time I was writing this book, I had two small children, and there was no greater terror in my imagination than the thought of losing one of them. And I suppose, like any parent with an imagination, I had in my imagination, in my nightmares, lost children many times. And I'd had friends who'd actually lost children and saw how they were devastated and changed forever. And it's a subject that comes up again and again in my books. And I was knowingly writing about something that was not autobiographical to me, but everything I most feared. As a writer, you write about everything you hope never happens to you. That is also psychologically a kind of autobiography, isn't it? You're almost saying, can I purge myself of this fear if I actualize it in my imagination? If I write about little Walt dying and Duncan being blinded in a car that is the result of adult and culpable adult sexual activity.
Yes, we should perhaps say for people who haven't read Garp that this is at the heart of the novel. The dark heart of it is this terrible accident that happens to Helen's and Garp's sons.
Yes, and it's an accident that's very New England in its nature, and that it sort of reflects the whole New England Puritan upbringing, that a sexual indiscretion, sexual wrongdoing of any kind can visit upon you your own worst fears, that there is no logical connection between marital infidelity and the death of a child. But I thought, what could be worse? What, you know, and my imagination goes that way. You create characters that you hope an audience will love, and then you visit upon them what you hope never happens to you and never happens to anyone you love. And that is it's very Greek, isn't it? I mean, think of the worst thing that could happen and what will the results be. I think as a kid one of the most devastating novels I read was The Mayor of Casterbridge. Still, in my opinion, the best first chapter in all of literature, The Mayor of Casterbridge.
Thomas Hardy.
This guy gets so drunk and so out of control that he loses his wife and daughter in a bet. right? And you think, as you read that first chapter, well, how is Michael Henschard ever going to recover from this? But the point is, he isn't. That's what the Mirror of Castle Bridge is about. Hardy is saying, there are things you can do that you don't recover from. So, yes, the short answer would be, yes, I was very deliberate about that, that ringer you speak of. But it seems to me that is my job as a storyteller, as a novelist, to sort of morally, emotionally engage you.
John Irving, we have a question for you now, which comes from a BBC listener in Ilorin in Nigeria. He's Bolaji Olatunde, and he rang in earlier to the programme, and we can hear him now.
Hi, Mr. Iden. This is Bolaji Olatunde calling from Nigeria. When you wrote about Cap's mother and how she allowed herself to be impregnated by his biological father, were you ever apprehensive that you could be stretching credulity too far in the minds of your readers? I believe that a woman anywhere would like to have or know the history of the father of her child.
So was Jenny Field's way of getting herself pregnant with Garp stretching the credulity of your readers?
Well, I would have to plead guilty as charged that stretching the credulity of my readers is also my job. If putting you through the ringer is what I see is my role as a writer, I would say pushing the envelope of believability is another task I set myself. Women who want to get pregnant and who want nothing to do with a live-in father of the child are very willful about what they want. I have met 20, 30 women since this book was published who've come up to me and said, I'm a Jenny Fields, I just didn't have a name for it. Thank you for giving me a name for it. Now, I'm sure these women, 201, didn't mean that they'd necessarily mounted a brain-damaged gunner. But you've got to remember that Jenny is a nurse, and things that would make many of us squeamish don't make nurses squeamish at all. My mother was a nurse. My mother could, I think, probably, and this isn't said in any way to disparage my mother. I say this with considerable admiration. I think my mother could carry on a conversation, empty a bedpan, and put on a condom with her other hand and not be the least distracted from either of those three tasks. You know, if you know nurses, they're very practical people. They're extremely practical people.
Staying in the arena of sexual politics, there's an email that was sent in to the BBC World Book Club from Prague in the Czech Republic from Anna Garber. And it concerns the extramarital affairs that both Garp and Helen have in the novel. Anna writes, I'm a 26-year-old woman who read Garp for the first time earlier this year. My question is, even ignoring the traumatic outcome of Helen's affair with Michael Milton, I still had a subconscious resentment towards her character when it came to her affairs, whilst with Garp I was more sympathetic. Is this an intentional undertone in the novel, or is it a socially ingrained bias on my behalf? The audience seems to know what it thinks.
Oh, well, clearly both. In other words, there is a sexually ingrained bias, and still is, that somehow a male infidelity is more forgivable than female infidelity. And what does that attitude, from my point of view, is also extremely condescending to men. It basically says, well, men can't help themselves, after all. It's just the case that we are less surprised by male infidelity than we are by female infidelity. I mean, how big a deal would it have been if Flaubert had written Monsieur Bovary? Right? I mean, would anyone have been surprised? I think no. Emma Bovary is more meaningful because it's her. It's her, right? So I think that it's not that I take Helen to more task than I take Garp to task for their infidelities. I have the manipulative hand of the Puritan ancestors I come from, saying, think about it in the world according to God. Sex comes with a terrible penalty. I mean, come on, it's just sex, and look what happens to them.
Because precisely, right. I mean, as she is having her farewell sexual act with her young lover.
She's trying to get rid of the guy. Oh, yeah, good that she bites his penis off, but the rest of it's not so nice.
There is an email from Angela Carista in Michigan in the USA who says, "Dear John Irving, are you concerned with providing justice to the characters in your novels because they seem to get exactly what they deserve?"
Oh.
Well, she says in the most satisfying way.
Oh, my. Well, I'm not quite as sure of myself as this reader is. I would say that people kind of get more than they deserve. The idea of justice, I think, is in real life for, especially for sexual behavior, absurd. There would be, in my view, far more grounds to impeach George W. Bush than there ever were to impeach Bill Clinton. I think that Bush is guilty of crimes against what the United States is supposed to stand for to far more extremes than being guilty of getting a blowjob from someone other than one's wife in the White House, right? The Clintons, and for the rest of her life, the daughter too, will be paying for his blowjob. How stupid is that? How petty, really, is that? So, yes, there is in the scheme of this novel a sense that for utterly human failures, people pay terrible prices. But I don't feel, as my reader in Michigan feels, that what happens to the people in this novel is deserved.
John Irving, The World According to Garp is, among other things, a novel about the whole process of writing and the existence of a writer, and I wonder if you could read us a passage from it now. It comes from quite early in the novel, and it's when Garp has just given Helen, they're both still schoolchildren, a copy of his first short story, and this is Helen's response to him.
I don't remember anything about this story at all. When I was asked to consider this extract, I was surprised to have discovered that I wrote this. Every once in a while, you do find these things. You know, I remember the letter, but what Garp's actual story was about is a total mystery to me. It's as if I'm reading it myself for the first time 30 years later. "Dear Garp, this story shows promise, although I do think at this point you are more of a wrestler than a writer. There is a care taken with the language and a feeling for people, but the situation seems rather contrived, and the ending of this story is pretty juvenile. I do appreciate you showing it to me, though. Yours, Helen." There would be other rejection letters in Garp's writing career, of course, but none would mean as much to him as this one. Helen had actually been kind. The story Garp gave her was about two young lovers who are murdered in a cemetery by the girl's father, who thinks they are grave robbers. After this unfortunate error, the lovers are buried side by side. For some completely unknown reason, their graves are promptly robbed. It is not certain what becomes of the father, not to mention the grave robber. That sounds utterly stupid. I don't know. Must have been a bad day. I don't know.
Question here.
Hello, I'm Helen Turner from Leeds in Yorkshire. My day job is working as a psychologist in a prison, so I'm really interested in the predictability and preventability of violence and tragedy. Do you have much hope that violence can be predicted or prevented in real life, and how?
I may be the least suited person to answer that question because I was such an angry kid and adolescent that I sought out this violent sport because of how much that violence was an outlet for me.
Meaning wrestling?
Yeah. I was drawn to it because I knew I would get hurt, and I knew I would get to hurt someone back. So, and certainly the subject of violence, the subject of how it begets itself, is indelibly part of my life as a novelist, as a storyteller. I often build a plot around a violent accident or a violent death. You know, what you recognize as a need in yourself or for yourself as an adolescent or as a young man is often something you hope to spare your children from. I think that my association with wrestling, which began out of nothing less than an inner anger and a love of violence, became, because I did it for so long, it became an aesthetic appreciation for a discipline and for a very precise craft, so that by the time I stopped competing as a wrestler after 20 years and became a trainer and a coach for other younger people, I was more concerned with them managing their anger. That was a principal concern to me, that they not be like me. Just as parents who've had what they feel are beneficial, if not idyllic, childhoods, can be wonderful parents because they are trying to recreate for their children the kind of sustaining, supportive childhoods they had. But the other kind of good parent, and I count myself as one, is coming at that experience of being a mother or a father from a different place, which is I would do anything to ensure that my children have a happier childhood than mine. And that can also give you a kind of concentration or devotion. I realize I'm ducking your question. that can I do I foresee in real life, you know, a way to curtail the violence?
We've got a question now that's been rung into the BBC World Book Club by Lynn Chong from New Hampshire in the USA, and it concerns the title of your novel.
Hello, John. My name is Lynn, and I live in New Hampshire. And I was a student with you in one class when I was a sophomore at the University of New Hampshire, and we both had Tom Williams for a teacher. And the question I have is about your title. You had a working title for GARP. You told a small University of New Hampshire student group, of which I was a part, about 1975, and that working title was an F word I can't say on the radio, and I wondered, was that irreverence helpful to you, keeping you entertained while you did this real work of writing a large novel? Or were you just joking with us?
Can you remember?
Well, I remember very well. The World According to GARP is the only title of my novel titles that I never liked. And I always considered it was a working title. That is, I didn't know what to call this book except The World According to GARP because of that sentence, first a first sentence, then a last sentence, therefore really always a last sentence. In The World According to GARP, we are all terminal cases, etc. That's what I wrote on the cover page. That's what was on the title page. But I always believed that the book would be called something else, that I would surely find a better title. And so the title referred to was one I often said, this book will be called something up. But there were other titles. That wasn't the only title I said. And I was experimenting. That must have been the one I was experimenting with at the time I gave that reading in 1975. To tell you the truth, I don't remember. But I simply believed that there had to be a better title than this. But when I submitted the novel and I told my editor, this is a working title, I'm looking for a better one. And he said, yes, it's a terrible title. I hope you do find something better and tell me when you get there. But everyone who finished the book said, that has to be the title. So that once someone read the book, they embraced that title. And every time I came up with an alternative, they said, no, it is The World According to Garpy. And I kept saying, but you said it was an awful title. Oh, well, but that's before I read it. So I couldn't find it. But it never happened before, and it's never happened since. I hope it doesn't. That is, every other title of every other novel was there at the beginning and never changed, and I never doubted it.
That is all the questions we've got time for. Next month, our book club guest will be the English comic novelist David Lodge, talking about Nice Work, his story of a feminist academic and a straight-talking factory manager whose utterly different worlds collide. If you'd like David Lodge to answer your question about Nice Work on the programme, you can email him, care of worldbookclub@bbc.co.uk. Or you can text him by dialing your international access code followed by 44 77 86 20 60 60. That's 44 77 86 20 60 60. And please tell him where you're writing from. For now, though, from me, Harriet Gilbert, and my producer, Karen Holden, thank you to all you members of the BBC World Book Club, whether listening at home or here in Hay-on-Wye, and thanks especially to this month's guest, John Irving. If you've enjoyed this programme, you might like to try other BBC podcasts. To find out more and view the full range available, visit bbcworldservice.com/podcast.